My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety dates February 11th, 2010. This is my home group. Got a sponsor, willing to sponsor others. And the person that I picked to speak for me tonight, he's a really good friend of mine. He used to be my sponsor a few years back. Obviously, I was in AA before and left for a while. But he was my sponsor before. He actually spoke for my first, like the second time I've done this, unfortunately. He spoke for my first year, celebrants meeting, whatever. And I guess like the reason I picked him to speak for me is, like, he was my first sponsor. He's the first one that took me to AA meetings. You know, when I got out of the treatment center that I was in, he let me crash on his couch, which is actually a funny story because the other guy that's going to speak and Ryan were there with him, and Eric, who's going to speak second, I guess they used to go at it all the time. It's kind of like a little happy reunion tonight. It's kind of cute. Those guys let me crash on their couch. You know, they helped me out a ton. When I came back this time, I decided that I wasn't going to ask him to be my sponsor, and I got another one. It was kind of it wasn't anything that he did wrong or anything, because I was the one that drank, you know, but it was more out of convenience. I was working in Sarasota. There was a guy there that I trusted really well, that I was really good friends with. I knew I could get through the steps quickly because I worked literally 5 feet away from him. I trusted him. I asked him to be my sponsor, so that was that. But I'm glad that I did that, because I feel like it's built my relationship with both of them. They're both really good friends. I love both of them to death. With Dave, we hang out, we watch football. You know, I can talk to him about anything, and it's not like I'm bad about sponsorship. Like, I'm going to tell somebody something, and then they're going to bitch at me, and then they're going to tell me what to do, and I'm going to tell them that I don't want to do that, and then I'm going to stop talking to them for weeks, you know? So, I just talk to Dave, you know? And he's a really good friend. Like, there's a few people in here that I, like, really trust. Like, I know a lot of people. I'm friends. I'm acquaintances with a lot of people. But there's a few people that I, like, really trust, you know? And Dave's one of them. When I came back this time, he was the first one that I called. You know, I wrestled for, like, a week or so with, should I come back? Should I not come back? Should I just go to a meeting and kind of see how it works? You know, am I an alcoholic? Am I not? Like, all that crazy stuff. And I just called Dave, and I was like, this is what's going on, man, and I think I should probably hang out with you. And he brought me to my first meeting this time again, you know? And it's like no questions asked, like not, oh, I'm doing this, or I'm, you know, I got this going on. It's like, okay, let's go, you know? And like, that's the kind of person that he is. He's just like a good person, you know? And I don't know, I guess that's pretty much it. It's just, you know, this is like a big deal for me. Like, I joke around a lot, and you know, I'm not like super serious all the time. To have a year of sobriety again, it really means a lot to me, you know? And it's not just having one year of sobriety doesn't necessarily mean that much, the time frame. It just means like I'm living my life better, and that's something to reflect that off of. So I feel like, you know, he's one of my best friends. He's a good person to come up here and celebrate it with me. So, it's Dave.
David, alcoholic. And congratulations, Mike. And it's an honor to do this for you a second time, you know. And congratulations, Stan, too. That's pretty cool, too. A little nervous. Sorry, guys. I don't know. David, alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 10th, 2002. This is my home group. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. And those are the things that keep me accountable to AA. And, you know, sorry. You know, from the beginning, you know, my father died from this disease when I was a baby. I was 3 years old. He was 25, you know, and he had a drug and alcohol problem. He was murdered in a drug deal. And I remember always knowing about that from the time that I was a little kid. And for some reason, you know, my mom always told me. And so I was always like, I'm not going to be like that. You know, I'm not going to smoke cigarettes and do drugs and all that stuff. And, you know, clearly that didn't work out because I'm here. So, but, you know, I tried alcohol a few times, you know, tried drinking it and stuff like that. And, you know, I had, sorry, getting to a slow start here. Anyway, so, you know, I tried sipping it and stuff, and I remember it just tasted terrible, and I could never really understand why people drank, you know. And but I remember going to parties with my parents, and it seemed like the more the adults were drinking, the more fun they were having, you know. And that matched up to me. That's what I took away from those experiences, was like alcohol equals fun, you know. And You know, I started hanging out with this, my best friend when I was in junior high, and he used to smoke a lot of pot, and he would always try to get me to do it. And I never would, you know, I was like, I don't know, I just didn't like to smoke or whatever. But one night we were hanging out with his brother-in-law, and he was like in his 20s, and he was like cool, drove a lowrider truck and stuff, and he, you know, they were kind of making fun of me for not smoking weed with them, and he goes, you guys should go get some Thunderbird. He's like, a wine buzz is way better than a weed buzz. And I was like, all right, I could do that, you know. And we went to the store and he bought us some Thunderbird. I was staying over at their house that night, and we're walking around the neighborhood and drinking. I didn't really get drunk that night, but I got pretty tipsy. You know, I was afraid to drink too much. Yeah, I didn't know what was going to happen. And but everybody that was in the neighborhood was like, oh, wow, you guys are drinking. That's awesome. And it was like cool to be us. You know what I mean? And everybody wanted what we had, you know. And I had a lot of fun in that experience. I didn't get in any trouble. We stayed out till like 4 o'clock in the morning just roaming around this neighborhood, you know. And it was a good time. And then, you know, I ended up, you know, smoking weed with him and stuff. He got me doing that. You know, drugs are definitely a part of my story. And, you know, if I don't talk about it, my story doesn't make sense. You know, and I don't know. Bill and Bob talked about drugs in their story, so I don't know why it's an issue, but whatever. anyway, so, you know, we started doing that later. You know, my brother had got sent away for getting in some trouble and stuff, so I was just always hanging out with this kid all the time. And he came back, and we started high school. We lived in Tampa, and we moved out to Land O'Lakes, and there was, like, nothing out there. So the only time we could hang out with anybody was at school. And in high school, we ended up making a lot of friends, like, really fast, you know, and started getting invited to parties and stuff. And that's where I started drinking a little bit more. I started doing acid and other stuff, too, and the deal was for me is I was just better at that stuff. You know, first of all, it was easier to get because, you know, the dope man never asked me for my ID, you know. And, you know, it's hard at 16 years old to walk into a store and buy liquor. So, and then, you know, we'd be at these parties and I would be drinking. And I could never, from the beginning, you know, my relationship with alcohol was different than my relationship with anything else, with the drugs and stuff. And I could never, like, get right to where I wanted to be. I would always overshoot the mark. And then I'm like puking behind the car. And in high school, that's definitely not cool. You know, the cool kids are not the ones with puke on their shirt. You know, and the girls didn't like that, you know. And so I had to stop that. So I just like walk around and like nurse one beer the entire night. What I would do is like if we were at a house party, my beer had to be super cold. It was the only way I could choke it down. I was always trying to figure out how I could drink successfully. You know what I mean? And I hated drinking. It's funny because we were at a detox a couple months ago, and I never heard anybody put it a way that made so much sense to me as a 16-year-old kid. He's like, I know I'm an alcoholic because I hate drinking, but I love being drunk. You know, and that was exactly what it was like for me. You know, I love the feeling of being drunk, but I hated trying to choke it down. You know, in fact, I had a friend who, you know, when I was like in my early 20s, he got married, and his father-in-law had mouth cancer and throat cancer, and they actually removed like most of his jaw, and he had to have it rebuilt. And while they were rebuilding it, he couldn't use his mouth for anything. It was just like completely shut and all bandaged up, and he had a feeding tube, and it would like, you know, stick out of his shirt, and when he had to pour, you know, his you know, food down there or whatever, and he was an alcoholic, you know, I guess, you know, he drank a lot, and he would pour beer in his feeding tube, and I remember seeing this, and I was like, wow, he is so lucky, like, you know, I'm like, man, if I could have that, I could get drunk all the time, and it wouldn't be a problem, you know, and that is not normal thinking, you know what I mean, like, normal people who drink don't wish they could pour it directly into their stomach, you know, and, but I didn't get that at the time, you know, and, you know, when I was 17, I got in a lot of trouble, you know, partying and stuff like that. I got a car, and I was just off doing my own thing, and my stepdad was like, if you're going to live here, you can't live like that. And I was like, fine, I don't need to live here, and I took off, you know. I had no job, nowhere to go, so I'm, like, sleeping on my friends' floors and in the closet so the parents don't know I'm there and stuff like that. After a couple of weeks of that, I realized living on my own wasn't that cool. And, you know, I asked my dad to come back, and he said I could come back, but I needed to figure out a plan. And I had a really good friend of mine, you know, we were, like, his family was, like, my second family, and they said I could come live with them in Connecticut because they had moved up there. And when I got up there, my drinking really took off, you know, because drugs were really hard to find, and if you could find them, they were super expensive. And You know, and there was this place where we could get a gallon of vodka for $5. It was really gross. It was disgusting, but, you know, but it did the job. And we had this kid, Pete, that we hung out with that was 18, but he looked like he was like 25. So he could go into the store and buy it for us. And so, you know, on weekends we used to party, and I used to get so belligerent. I remember there was this kid, Mike, that hung out with us, and we hated each other all the time. We were always fighting, you know. And but when we were drinking together, we were like best friends. And we would take the gallon of vodka and go in the kitchen and go shot for shot. Whoever puked first lost, and it was usually me. You know, after like six shots, I'd be puking up like crazy. But and this one particular night, I just kept going. I was going strong. I was like, I am not losing tonight. You know what I mean? Man, we were going and going and going. And all of a sudden, I'm like just puking my guts out in this trash can. I'm like sitting on this little footstool in the kitchen. And I looked down the hall and I could see into the bathroom. And my buddy Tim was in there. And he was like just this really big guy. And he's sitting on the trash can. And it's like smashed underneath him. And he's puking into the toilet. So I start laughing at him. And I start puking some more. Then he's laughing at me for puking. And he starts puking some more. You know? And I don't really remember much after that. But my friends found me upstairs in the toilet bowl. I was literally asleep in the toilet bowl from here up. My head was in the water, you know, and I was just passed out there. That's where they found me. And they pulled me out of the toilet, and I woke up the next morning in this Lion King bed that was like this big. The person whose house we were at had like a, you know, she had a three-year-old. So, and I remember them telling me about the night, and I was like, man, that was awesome, you know. And I guess at some point I got really homesick, and I was like bawling on the couch and stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. But no, that's how I drank at 17. A couple, you know, about a week later, we were watching the Super Bowl, you know, and we're hanging out and we're drinking and stuff like that. And this guy that lived a couple doors down, he was like 30-something, and he hung out with all his kids, which was kind of weird. But, you know, he had gotten a car accident, and his leg got crushed, and he had it held together with a titanium rod, you know. So he couldn't walk. He was on crutches. And he was, like, throwing eggs at us. And he was missing us on purpose, but I really got offended by that, you know what I mean? And so I'm like up in his face, and he's holding himself up by his crutches, and we're like talking trash. And, you know, I'm like ready to beat this guy up because I'm a real tough guy, you know? He's like can't even stand. And I take his crutch and I break it, you know, and I'm like bragging, you know, I'm like yelling about that. And then he keeps running his mouth, so I take his other crutch and I toss it out in the snow, you know? So he's like holding himself up on the wall, and everybody's like separating us and stuff. And so, you know, they called the cops, and I was like bragging everybody. I actually took that crutch and I nailed it to my wall, you know, and I was like bragging everybody like a week later about it, you know, how awesome it was. And I don't know, I'm just completely belligerent when I drink, you know, that's just how my drinking was. And so I recognized then that I had a problem, and I got kicked out of there and I had to come home. And, you know, I came home and I was like, I really need to chill out on the drinking. So I'm just going to, I'm going to smoke weed and I'm going to work a lot. I got two jobs and I started doing that, you know. Through a series of events, you know, I started hanging out with people and going to clubs and stuff like that. You know, I always said I was never going to do drugs, you know. I started drinking and smoking weed and doing acid at 16. At 18, I did coke for the first time, and at 19, I was shooting heroin, you know. And as I would get to each step, it never seemed like the next step was so far down. You know, it didn't seem like, you know, if I'm snorting coke, it's not that bad as long as I'm not doing heroin. And if I'm doing heroin, it's not that bad as long as I don't start shooting up. And if I'm shooting up, as long as I don't start smoking crack, everything's okay. You know what I mean? And by the end, I'm like smoking crack and breaking it down to shoot up and stuff. And you know what I mean? And so, you know, anyway, so it was just back and forth with that stuff for the longest time. And I always used to think that heroin was a problem. And I thought, I'll just drink. You know, and like I said, my relationship with alcohol was different. And so I would drink, and I would always get too drunk. It was always a roll of the dice. I never knew what was going to happen when I drank. You know, sometimes I would go out and have two or three beers and go home. Other times I would go out and I would start drinking, and I'd wake up in jail. You know what I mean? I would get in fights. All this, like I said, it was just a roll of the dice. You know, it was like just safer for me to do drugs. You know, it just made, so I would, things would get out of control with drinking, so I would go back to doing drugs. And things would get out of control with that, so I'd go back to drinking. For me, being sober was just not an option. I wasn't having it, you know. And I didn't realize that. It was always like something else. If I could just balance everything out, I'd be okay. Through a series of events, you know, I ended up in a methadone clinic. And I never wanted to get on methadone, you know. I was like, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, my dad was on methadone. And he used to go down and cop his dope and then go out and he would get his methadone and then he would go cop dope and still get wasted, you know. So I was like, I'm not going to waste my time with that. One day, for some reason, you know, my brother and a friend came over and they had just started going to the clinic. And they told me about it, and all of a sudden it sounded like the right thing to do. You know, I was like, okay, whatever. I think at this point I was just so beaten down, you know, I had nothing left, you know. I was living in a one-bedroom apartment, and somebody had asked me to babysit this dog. You know, I still have him today. You know, that was like 9 years ago. And I was completely incapable of taking care of him, so there was pee and crap all over the house. And I had been stealing electricity for like 4 months. Once a month I would come home, and my electricity would be turned off, and I would go out and turn it back on. Then they got wise to that, so they took the meter. And so I couldn't turn it back on myself. So then I went and stole one from an abandoned apartment and used that to keep my electricity on. But I didn't want to get caught doing that, so I would only have electricity on from like 8 at night to like 6 in the morning. You know what I mean? And it's July, you know, it was miserable, you know. But I was okay with living that way. You know, I got to that point where life was okay like that. Anyway, so I go to this methadone clinic, and, you know, because my problem is heroin. And so I think. And I start, I get on that stuff, and all of a sudden my drinking is out of control, and I'm doing coke and all this other stuff, and I can't understand why things aren't getting better, you know what I mean? And so one day I just decided I was going to pray. I don't know why. You know, when I was a kid, I used to go to church a lot. For some reason, my parents never took me. I just used to get up and go. But this one day I just prayed, and I was like, God, you know, help me find a church with young people, you know, some pretty girls, and I'll start living right. You know what I mean? And that was my deal. You know, you hook me up, I'll hook you up. And you know, I went to the methadone clinic the next day, and I told my counselor, I was like on fire with it, you know, like yeah, everything's gonna be great and this and that. And then he introduced me to this new counselor that they had, and he said she's involved with a young people's church. And he introduced me to her, and we started talking, and she was like, yeah, you know, I know this. She's like, yeah, I can take you to church and stuff like that, you know, like gave me her number or whatever. And then immediately it was a terrible idea to go to church. Like right when I had somebody willing to pick me up, I was like, yeah, that's probably stupid, you know. But then she started telling me about this young people, this AA meeting, and I'm like, nah, like I'm at the methadone clinic, you know, I got a problem with alcohol, you know. And meanwhile, I was probably drunk the night before, you know, before I got there. And she was, because at this point I hadn't done any drugs really in like months, you know, but I've been drinking with my friends all the time, and just getting out of control. And you know, so my counselor ended up getting fired, and they made her my counselor because we had already known each other. And right from day one, she kept telling me about this meeting, like, come to this meeting. And I'm like, no. And she kept saying this guy would pick me up for the meeting. And finally one day she just picked up the phone, and she called this guy, and she said, hey, Jeremy, somebody wants to go to a meeting, hold on. And gave me the phone. And you know, I pick up the phone, and this guy gets on the other line, and he's like, hey, man, how's it going? You want to go to a meeting tonight? It'll be awesome. I'll come pick you up. And I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, who is this guy? You know, he's just like screaming in my ear. I'm like, you know? And I was just like, whatever. Yeah, I really didn't think he was going to pick me up, so I told him where I lived, you know? And if I thought he was going to show up, I wouldn't have done that, you know? But I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, you're going to pick up a junkie from a methadone clinic? Come on. You don't even know me. And so I gave him my address, and he ended up showing up that night. You know, I get in the car. And, you know, we drive to pick up a couple other people, and I'm just sitting in the back, like, just hating life. Like, this is miserable. I just want to be home watching Dexter's Laboratory, you know? And that's all I did. I would just lay on the couch and just watch Cartoon Network over and over. It was awesome. And, you know, and I remember being at the meeting. I don't remember anything that happened in the meeting. And I remember after the meeting, this guy, you know, my counselor was there, which was really odd. And she came up to me, and she's like, hey, you know, you're going to get a sponsor and this and that. And I'm like, no, I'm not coming back here, you know. I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. And she kept being like, hey, go talk to that guy over there. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then he came up to me, and he's like, you got a sponsor? And I was like, he's asking me all these questions. And you got a sponsor? And I'm like, no. And then he would leave and come back like 5 minutes later and be like, you got a sponsor? And I'm like, I'm still staying in the same spot, you know. And I didn't do anything about it that night, but a couple weeks later I was back at the meeting. I don't even remember how I got to the meeting this time, you know. I just remember being at the meeting, and the same thing was going down. She was there, and I'm like, why is she at the meeting? Like, is she following me around? Like, what the hell, you know? And she came up, and she asked me about he came up and he asked me if I had a sponsor again, and I was like no. And then he like kept walking. He kept doing the same thing, walking back and forth, asking about a sponsor. Finally, I was like, do you want to do it? Like, and then he was like, well, can you follow direction? And I lied and said, yeah, you know. And then he goes, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And I lied again, and I said, yeah. You know, and I wasn't willing to do any of that. I just wanted people to stop asking if I had a sponsor, you know. And, you know, but what happened was he started picking me up for meetings every day. You know, every day. It was just coming to my house. And I hated going to meetings. And we would get in the car, and I would be so pissed off that I was going. I didn't like anybody here. I wasn't shy that I didn't like anybody here, you know. And, you know, I let people know what I thought. And no matter how much of a jerk off I was, though, every week they were picking me up. You know what I mean? And they would... And one thing he did was in the beginning, you know, he got me doing stuff. He made me the assistant coffee guy, which means that my job was to fill up the coffee pot with water and carry it over to where they're making the coffee. And that thing, when it's full for 100 cups, you know, that thing's heavy as hell. You know, I'm thinking he's just lazy, you know, like, geez, making me do his work, you know. And then they made me the cleanup guy. And I'm like, I see how this works. You know, you want me to do this stuff you guys don't want to do. You know, I'd be so pissed cleaning up the meeting. But what happened was I would have to get to the meeting early so that I could assist with the coffee. And then I would have to stay late so that I could clean up. And the other people that were getting there early were becoming my friends. And then the people that were staying late after the meeting, they were, you know, I was becoming friends with them. And I started becoming a part of, you know. And it started not being somewhere where I was going and a chore that I was doing, but it started me being, you know, this is my meeting, you know, and this is where I go. And I was a part of, you know, I was a part of it all. And, you know, and but I remember in the beginning, you know, I was on methadone for the first 4 months, and I wasn't, I couldn't count my time, you know. I used to argue with my sponsor about that all the time, you know, like, why can't I pick up chips? He's like, you're high right now. He's like, you couldn't even hold your head up in the meeting. Pick up some chairs, you know what I mean? And I used to be so resentful at that. Like, new guys, I was in the group for like 3 months, and a guy would come in like with 1 day sober, and I'm sitting in the back seat because he's sober longer than me. I'm like, what the hell, you know? And in my pigeon family, whoever has the most time gets the front seat, you know. So it was unbearable, you know. And you know, I remember when Ryan came in, I was like, yes, a new guy. And then I was like, how much time do you have? He's like, 3 months. I was like, geez, at this time I had like a month, you know what I mean? And I was like, damn, everybody has more time than me. You know, it seemed like it was like that for a year, you know? But anyway, that doesn't matter. Anyway, the reason I say that is because in the beginning I was so angry and so resentful. And even when I was doing stuff, I would sit in the back and I had this one guy that I would hang out with. And we both just, you know, we were here. And I wasn't counting my time, but I used to say I watched people and watched what they were doing. Really, I sat in the back and I judged everyone, you know what I mean, and what they were doing. But what I would see happen was people would come in and they would get sponsors and they would start doing service work. And they would, you know, they would get involved in the steps and they would become a part of, and they would get better. You know, the lives were getting better. They were getting stuff back. You know what I mean? And meanwhile, I'm in the back just pissed off at everybody that my life isn't getting better. And the whole time I'm thinking it's because I don't belong here. You know, I'm thinking I don't belong here. I got a drug problem. And so I'm arguing with my sponsor about that all the time. You know, and he would always say to me, he would say, well, maybe you'll hear something today, you know. And and one day we were talking about it, and he said, he goes, you know, if you take all that stuff, because when I was getting off methadone, they were telling me I needed to be on all these meds because I'm bipolar and all this stuff. And they were like, if you take all that stuff and you trade it in for alcoholism, and you just, geez, that's not even the right part for me to start crying at. But he said, if you trade all this stuff in for alcoholism and you do what we do here and you work this program, your life will get better. And I didn't believe that that was true. But I could tell by the way he said that to me that he did, you know. And so I started doing that stuff. You know, I got off the methadone and I was 13 days sober and I did my first fifth step. You know, I just got right into it, you know. And since then, things have been up and down. The one thing that's kept me grounded, though, definitely, was I used to be really, like, really involved in, like, doing service work. And I thought that was it. Like, that was where it's at. Like, I could stay sober forever just doing that stuff. And I would, you know, but then it became, like, the David Show. You know, it was like, look at all the guys David's got in his car, you know what I mean, and stuff like that. And just driving around and doing all this. And I love telling people how much service work I did. And I love people patting me on the back, talking about being a young guy, doing so much service and being so involved. And I didn't even realize that that was going on, you know. And a lot of it was being sober by default. You know, my sponsor was really sober. Actually, the only reason I even started doing service work was because I hated my sponsor. And I heard from somebody that the only good reason to ever change sponsors is if your sponsor drinks or he does less than you in AA. So I was like, I'm going to do more than him in AA so that I can get a new sponsor and I can tell everybody how much better I am than him. You know what I mean? And I got to tell you, it is impossible to do more service work than him. I don't even know. Like, his mind is just always focused on the newcomer, just bouncing off the wall. I try to be like that, you know, but I'm so self-centered, it's ridiculous. But, true. And, but really, like, doing service work and stuff. But then, what happens is at some point, just going to meetings and not drinking. And I hear hear that all the time, just go to meetings and don't drink. And at some point, I was relieved of the obsession to drink. And so alcohol and drugs was not my problem. You know what I mean? And so I had to get into action. I had to start working on myself, because it doesn't matter how many new guys I'm picking up. If I'm not working on me, what kind of message am I carrying? You know what I mean? And it's hard to stay in that. It really is, especially like life starts coming at you and things change. And at some point too, my life is so different now. I can't do the things that I used to do. I can't rely on just showing up and doing service work and stuff like that. I really gotta stay in touch with AA and the program, my sponsor and the people that helped me get through this, and talking to guys like Mike. When these guys call, I gotta be there. If I can't pick them up, I gotta pick up the phone and talk. And sometimes I don't want to. Sometimes, I got a newborn baby, I don't want to talk on the phone. I want to relax. I got 5 minutes, like, before she's going to wake up and want to eat again. I do not want to talk to a new guy, but I have to. You know what I mean? I have to if I want to still be able to be in that position to be her father. You know what I mean? And, I don't know if my time's up or not, but that's just the deal. I got to stay focused and I got to stay in this, because my life today is amazing. I have things today that I never thought I would. And I really spend most of my time thinking about all the things I don't have, sometimes I get up here and speak, and it really reminds me of the things I do have. I hate speaking. It's like the worst thing somebody can ask me to do in AA, besides picking up cigarette butts, But I'm really grateful that Mike came back, and that he's able to celebrate a year, and that I'm able to come up here and talk for him. And it's awesome to see Stan make 5 years. Who thought that would happen? Jeez. I love you, Stan. I don't know where you're at, but anyway, that's all I got. Thanks.